Facing the Buddha, very nice. Clearing the mind, just let everything go. With deep respect. Oh, Namo Manjushriye. Namo Sushriye. Namo Uttamashriye Soham. Oh, Namo Manjushriye. Namo Sushriye. Namo Uttamashriye Soham. Oh, Namo Manjushriye. Namo Sushriye. Namo Uttamashriye Soham. Thank you. Once more, page 73 in the prayer book. As I say to you quite often, as we do the prayers, see if you can identify those aspects of the prayers that we've actually been studying, thinking about, and meditating. To the Founder, the Endowed Transcendent Destroyer, the One Gone Beyond, the Four Destroyer, the Completely Perfected, Fully Awakened Being, perfect in knowledge and in good conduct, Sugata, Knower of the World, Supreme Guide of Human Beings to be Tamed, Teacher of Gods and Human Beings, to you the Completely and Fully Awakened One, the Endowed Transcendent Destroyer, the Glorious Conqueror, the Subduer from the Shakya Clan, I prostrate, make offerings, and go for refuge. The Founder, the Endowed Transcendent Destroyer, the One Gone Beyond, the Four Destroyer, the Completely Perfected, Fully Awakened Being, perfect in knowledge and in good conduct, Sugata, Knower of the World, Supreme Guide of Human Beings to be Tamed, Teachers of Gods and Human Beings, to you the Completely and Fully Awakened One, the Endowed Transcendent Destroyer, the Glorious Conqueror, the Subduer from the Shakya Clan, I prostrate, make offerings, and go for refuge. To the Founder, the Endowed Transcendent Destroyer, the One Gone Beyond, the Four Destroyer, the Completely Perfected, Fully Awakened Being, perfect in knowledge and in good conduct, Sugata, Knower of the World, Supreme Guide of Human Beings to be Tamed, Teacher of Gods and Human Beings, to you the Completely and Fully Awakened One, the Endowed Transcendent Destroyer, the Glorious Conqueror, the Subduer from the Shakya Clan, I prostrate, make offerings, and go for refuge. When, O Supreme amongst humans, you were born on this earth, you paced out seven strides, then said, I am supreme in this world. To you who were wise then, I prostrate. With pure bodies, form supremely pure, wisdom ocean like a golden mountain, fame that blazes in the three worlds, winner of the best, Lord, to you I prostrate. With the supreme signs, face like spotless moon, color like gold, to you I prostrate. Dust free, like you, the three worlds are not. Incomparably wise one, to you I prostrate. The Saviour having great compassion, the Founder having all understanding, the field of merit with qualities like a vast ocean, to you, the one gone to thusness, I prostrate. The purity that frees one from attachment, the virtue that frees one from the lower realms. The one path, the sublime pure reality, to the Dharma that pacifies, I prostrate. Those who are liberated and who also show the path to liberation, the holy few qualified with realizations who are devoted to the moral precepts, to you, the sublime community intending virtue, I prostrate. Homage to the Supreme Buddha, homage to the Dharma refuge, homage to the great Sangha, to all three, ever devout homage. To all worthy of respect, bowing with bodies as many as all realms, atoms in all aspects, with supreme faith, I pay homage. Do not commit any non-virtuous actions. Perform only perfect virtuous actions. Do your mind thoroughly, this is the teaching of the Buddha. Star, a mirage, a flame of a lamp, an illusion, a drop of dew or a bubble, a dream, a flash of lightning, a cloud. Decondition things as such. Through these merits, may sentient beings attain the rank of all seer, but through the four faults, and be delivered from samsara's ocean, perturbed by the waves of aging, a few things before we start. First, Gabriel, that book that I was telling you about, I had a good look at it last night because, as you know, I've only recently bought it. What it is, it is by Ian Stevenson, not his, not the people who work with him. It was published in 79. I've read quite a few, well, a few years ago, I read quite a few of the papers. What he's done, though, he's taken a lot of the abstracts of all the papers and put it into this one volume. And it's called Where Reincarnation and Biology Intersect. Where Reincarnation and Biology Intersect. And it's by Ian Stevenson. It says Ian Stevenson, MD, University, I think it's University of Virginia, 1997. And it was interesting because I read it, I didn't read it all, but I read a lot and I kept thinking, I've read that. And then I went and read the introduction, and it's actually a collection, a strong abstract, because not a Buddhist, not coming at it from a theological point of view, coming across it from a biological point of view, and then marrying it up by what was observable, measurable, in those that he interviewed about having had past lives. So that's quite interesting. Dina? Dina? Morning. I found my notes on time. Do you want to take a note of this?
Yes.
My notes on this were quite brief, but here's what I wrote down, and it's what I remember. The time is an artifact of the mind. An artifact of the mind. It's not an absolute. It's not an absolute container in which events occur. It is a conceptual view. I said to you yesterday that it had its own category, and I was right. And this category is called a non-congruent affecting variable. Bluff with that. When you study epistemology, that I presume at some stage that will become interesting. <I don't know. laughs> But the bits I took notes of were the things that were important to me, like time is a non-static phenomena, a non-static phenomena. In Buddhism, it's seen as neither a physical phenomena, it's not a physical phenomena, nor is it a way of being aware of something. It is simply a concept imputed on a non-static continuum. I'm going to say that again. It's a non-static phenomena, neither physical nor a way of being. A way of being aware of something, that is. It's a concept imputed on a non-static continuum. That becomes very important. How they describe it, it's time is an interval on an individual's mental continuum. The time is an interval on an individual's mental continuum between the experiences of two consecutive moments. And when I looked at it further years ago, I basically made this note. Lose the concepts, lose the idea of time. That's what I put. But I would definitely, investigate that myself. This was nearly 30 years ago. So like I say, once I realized those little bit, then that was enough for me to continue. For those who are really interested, who really want to go in, then it will become quite important when you study epistemology. Because there, if you remember, it's looking at the different types of knowledge. It's looking at what you know, how you know what you know. Yes, how you know what you know. Epistemology. And they go into things in great depth. You're looking at manifest phenomena. You're looking at slightly obscured phenomena. You're looking at obscured phenomena. So in the epistemology, time is really considered to be a compounded, therefore impermanent phenomena. Time is seen to be without past or future. So I think epistemology is the way if you want to delve into that any deeper. That's my homework done. I searched for it yesterday, couldn't find it. Came to the conclusion last night was, I now know exactly where it isn't. I was completely sure, I couldn't go to sleep. I thought, where is it? And then I thought, no, go to sleep. Be happy to know it's not where you looked. I thought, that's reasonable, right? So this morning, I woke up thinking, well, let's look where you've not looked before. So then I found it, so that was fun.
Thank you,
You're welcome. We're not all locked up yet, are we, really? So I thought we'd start this morning just by reviewing some of the main points of yesterday. Some of the main points of yesterday. So if you've made notes, maybe just review them now. You can never hear these things enough, believe me, never. Start with a huge overview. So that the overview is this: everything that we study in Dharma, every teaching we listen to, every way we behave within the Buddha Dharma has got one purpose, and that's to point us away, take us away from the fantasy, the unreal way of behaving in the world. It takes us away from misknowing how phenomena exist. And all the teachings lead us towards understanding this nature of reality. How we exist, why we exist, how we experience life in all its dramas, all the complexity. And for this, impermanence is the foundational principle of all of this. I said to you yesterday, impermanence, this river of cause and effect, is a river that if you get on that river and understand it, this ever-flowing, non-abiding, ever-changing river, which is the nature of conditioned existence, will lead you into the wisdom of emptiness. Absolutely. What else do I want to repeat? So much. Understanding the impermanence is that which changes moment to moment. You want a short, brief, concise definition? That which changes moment to moment. Going deeper, you're looking at all phenomena, compounded phenomena. There isn't a conceivable fraction of a moment of time where there is no change. Even moment to moment, within that one moment, people think there's something solid and real, and there isn't. There isn't a fraction of that moment that has static. There is not anything that has time to abide, however small duration of time. If anything can do that, then it's permanent. Permanence is unchanging. So anything that's opposite to what I've said about impermanence is in fact permanent. And we went into that. Well, how to generally understand this? Well, just know and study, you know, and then come to an understanding that if it functions, if that phenomena has a function, we consider that all functioning phenomena are impermanent. Whether it's visible, whether it's consciousness, doesn't matter. A year, a person, a country, doesn't matter. If it's functioning, it is impermanent. And permanence is the opposite to that. This is a non-functioning phenomenon. It doesn't come about by causes of generation. We went into a little bit into permanence, but the thing to remember about permanent, any permanent phenomena can only be known through the mind. Cannot be known through the five senses. You come to a conclusion of permanence by seeing through something and then inferring. That's how permanence works. There's a lot of static at the moment. Any way of trying to reduce that?
I don't think so, I'm afraid.
Okay, not to worry. Not to worry.
Yeah, I haven't muted you. I should have done that.
I know, it's not easy. So the other thing to remember is that when you're looking at impermanence, you will come to two ways of looking at impermanence, both real. There is what's called gross impermanence. And there's lots of teaching on that. But in a nutshell, gross impermanence is impermanence that you can see because it's being caused by an outside object. Consider the planes flying into the Twin Towers. Those towers collapsed. They were impermanent because planes flew into them. Yes, flew into them. So that's gross. But when we get to wisdom, the wisdom you're looking at here, the impermanence you need is subtle impermanence. Subtle impermanence. You need to go deeper. So you're looking at impermanence broadly as the cessation of a physical continuum. You're looking at as impermanence as not abiding in a subsequent moment as in the first. You're looking at it as impermanence, but that from the very beginning of that first moment continues to change. From the very beginning, middle, end, always changing. Why is all this happening? Subtle impermanence? Because that's its nature. That is the nature of conditioned phenomena. This subtle impermanence is the nature. And that's important. Nature is important. This is something that's going to happen whether you want it or you don't want it. This happens. Don't need to do that again. So we're really looking at that because really what you're trying to do is journey towards subtle wisdom and away from ignorance. What we're doing this for is we're trying to reduce the disparity between intellectual understanding something and the way we behave in the world. And because of that, if you're interested in understanding the wisdom and nature of reality, there's no better friend to you than subtle impermanence. None. Then we did meditation, that was fine. Then we looked at this, we said, if you're looking at what makes up wisdom, you really are looking at three points: impermanence, dependent arising, and emptiness itself. Impermanence, dependent arising, and emptiness. Together, they expose the true nature of reality. And what is really important, very, very important, is they're mutually supportive. Mutually supportive. And you can consider them mutually supportive as seeing impermanence as the environment from which grows, from which is revealed, actually, dependent arising and emptiness. So if you see it like that, it'll be very, very handy. If this is the case, where is the permanent, unchanging I, the self-existing I, inherent of myself, others, and all phenomena? This is what impermanence is leading to. If this is the case, then where is this solid I that always seems to be there? If everything is constantly changing, how do functioning phenomena exist? You're saying it doesn't do this and it doesn't do that. It is ever flowing, but how does it exist? How does it exist? And the answer is it exists dependently. Functioning phenomena are dependently arising. That's how they exist. But we don't see that. We don't see dependent arising as it happens. What we see, and we behave as if it's true, is independent self-existent phenomena. So how do phenomena exist? They exist dependently. They are a dependent arising. That's quite crucial. If they're dependently arising, what are they dependent upon? And if you were doing maybe a couple, 2-3 days on this, we would go into this in more depth. But in a nutshell, what are they dependent upon then? They're dependent upon causes and conditions. They're dependent upon their parts. And they're dependent on the mind that labels them. And it's possible that you get some very subtle phenomena that it's not all three. For something to be a dependent arising, only one of these things needs to be true. So within this constant change then, how do I behave? How do I function? I function dependently as well. I function interdependently. As the late Thich Nhat Hanh used to say, inter-I. I exist causally. I exist because of my parts and because the mind that labels me who I am. But what's important? All of this is mutually supportive, all of it. And although there's many ways of looking at this, again, in a nutshell, it's important to really grasp straight away that this I is so, this I is so strong. But now consider, this I only exists as a mere label based on the five aggregates. It's a label based on the five aggregates that make up who you are that allows you to be functioning in the world and to discuss it. This I is only the I, me, mine, in relation to other. You see, as soon as the I is strong, then you create others. Others. But you only exist as an I because of the others. To another individual, you're in the category of other. We see ourselves in the category of I and everybody else. But all the billions of people in the world, you are in the camp of the other. They are the I. And so you have to try and get a taste of this mutual dependency. So even this I that you hold quite strong is really there, dependent. It doesn't exist, but it has efficacy, but it doesn't really exist. But we posit it in relation to the other. If the other wasn't there, would there be a need to say I? Well, only if you're Scottish, I suppose. So that's that. Did we do that? Yeah. Pink label. So we then said, finishing up with the idea, that if you were to describe emptiness, somebody would say to you, what is this emptiness? You say it's the ultimate truth. It's the actual way in which everything exists. How much teachings is there on this wisdom? Countless teachings, countless. Different schools can have slight difference of opinion with the nature of emptiness, depending on the first, second, and third turning of the Wheel of Dharma. But within the teachings, within the Perfection of Wisdom teaching, there's 100,000 lines devoted to emptiness. And there's not one word in those 100,000 lines that are there just for fun or to pad anything out. Each line, each word has got wisdom in it. And in the Prajnaparamita, the Perfection of Wisdom, when they categorize all that, they categorize it into 108 categories of emptiness. This can be condensed, not by throwing stuff out, but by condensing it into 16 categories, then into 4, and eventually into 2. Try to remember, can you remember what the 2 categories might be of emptiness that's easier to look at? So it's the emptiness of self and the emptiness of phenomena, these 2 categories. So here we're looking at things with both a conventional mind. Well, we're always looking at things with a conventional mind, but we're also considering the possibility of an ultimate way of seeing things. So from a conventional point of view, you can say, and it's reasonable to say, everything exists as either subject or object. We talked about that. If accepted, you could say that all phenomena exist in this way. Or at least they appear to exist in this way. You can make it more personal. You can say, therefore, in a conventional way, you can split this down to the observer and that which is observed. You start to approach the ultimate way of looking at to understand that these are mutually dependent. Mutually dependent. So from a conventional way of looking at things, using a conventional mind, it seems that all knowable things, when perceived by the mind, appears to exist independently, appears to exist in and of itself, appears to have somewhere within it permanence, some sort of self within each object at some stage. And that's the same thing by saying it appears to exist by its own character. It seems to be self-existent, seems to be inherently existent. All that means roughly the same thing. Not quite, but roughly the same thing. It's okay for the moment. And within the Buddha Dharma, this, without any doubt, is the actual source of all suffering, all discontentment. Complete source. And I refer you again to the handout. We won't look at it just now, but that handout I gave you, Geshe Tashi's diagram. Where does it start? It starts with ignorance. This is what we're looking at. We then went on to look at the two types of ignorance, learned ignorance and innate. Then we looked at the idea that, no, we'll go here. All masters in all schools of Dharma say that when you approach the study, the reflection and the meditations on emptiness, there is one way you have to start. Everyone has to start this way. And that is to identify what is called the object of negation. The object of negation. We have to identify that which does not exist. This inherently existent I. It's the first step, and it can be the most difficult step. This self-existent I, we are so habituated life after lifetime, we never even consider the question. And in fact, without any thinking or studying, it's rare if you said to someone, you know, does this concept of myself, this I, do you think it exists? Can you imagine most people's reaction? This is, the I is an absolute paramount escapee. It hides everywhere. It is so clever that you never even question its existence. In the same way you have a head, two arms and two legs, you have an eye. So of course, if you're approaching wisdom, then the very first step, as all the great masters say, is you have to identify the object of negation. You have to identify that which is not there. What is it? And yesterday, if you remember, we did some exercises where you got angry. Our normal way of looking at getting angry is, this caused me to be angry. This and this and this. And I, of course I got angry. Look what was going on. What you were looking at there was really going deeper. To see that that anger really arose from the strong sense of I. So this is an exercise that's worth doing quite often. One of the most powerful ways is criticism. We cannot abide it as human beings. I don't care how you dress it up. We cannot abide it. No one can. And so remembering a time when you were criticized, and let's face it, we've all been there. Instead of immediately, which is our habit, they said this and I never really did that. And they don't know, does this have an effect? Of course it has an effect, but it's not your source. It's not the source. So imagining yourself getting, being criticized, but going deep, people it, get the environment right and go into meditation and get the person saying what they say and look at it closely. And you'll see there is a dependent arising going on here. This idea of self is really where this feelings that you get when someone criticizes. If it were truly external to you, truly, you could have three people, your three friends sitting there, and each one of them giving the same type of criticism. One really upset. How could they possibly do that? The second one, okay, yeah, maybe there's a point, There's always a point, and that's the problem with criticism. In the middle of that criticism, there's something that's actually true. If it weren't true, we wouldn't get that annoyed. And then the third person listens to the criticism and goes, two coffees, please. Doesn't bother them. How could you have three different responses to a similar situation? Now you can say, I know, well, everybody's got their own genetic makeup, everybody's got these predispositions, but being criticized goes beyond all that. It's a universal thing that will get everybody. It has an effect, of course, but it's not where it comes from. And so helping to identify this I that we believe is here, is you have to make it arise. You have to see, one, how it arises, and two, look at it and say, who are you? Where are you? If you're this strong, I ought to be able to find you. Like that. That's the beginning of all of that. So this first step is really about recognizing the falsely appearing self. It's the most important step. This I is the I that's to be refuted. In the text, it's called to be refuted. You're not refuting the efficacy of it. You're refuting its existence. So to allow that to come up, we did the cliff. To be able to look at it, we did the cliff exercise meditation. But you can use anything. And at this time, it's good to say, if anything bad has ever happened to you, where you've got really, really upset, really, really angry. I mean, you know what I'm talking about. Some real, squirrel it away. It's going to be extremely useful. Then in the safety of the meditation, you're out of the close contact with it, but you bring it up again. You can bring it up again, but this time, look at it deeply. Look at it with wisdom eyes. See what's going on. Where did it come from? How does it exist? And by the way, where did it go? I'm not feeling like that now. So this is the way where even when negative things happen to you, as long as it doesn't keep hurting you, if it's going to keep hurting you, not helpful. But if in a retreat, if in a situation, a quiet situation, where you're past the hurt, but it did hurt, then in the safety of a meditation, you can use that. And it said, my teachers used to say to me, and people who have had a hard life and difficult situations, they find the eye very quickly. People who have had an easy life where not so much has happened, you know, like that, they have to fabricate it. Live long enough, you'll never have to fabricate. No. Okay, good. Okay, was there anything on that? Now, that's just a quick review. Well, my type of quick review. Yes, Fina.
Can I just check on something?
Uh-huh.
Are we refuting the I completely, or are we accepting that the I is something that is changing moment by moment?
You're refuting the solidly existing, non-existing I. You're refuting the inherently existing, permanent thing that you have. What you're not refuting is the label of I posited on a collection of aggregates that changes moment to moment. This is why when people say to you that Buddhism can be is nihilistic, it doesn't. It's this idea of non-self, you don't exist. That's nonsense. It's just a misunderstanding of the word non-existent, of the concept of non-existence. Always keep thinking, of course I exist, just not the way I think. Any other thoughts just to clarify that, or is that reasonable? Okay. So please put yourself into a meditative state. How easy is that? No problem. Just relax, get the body right. Let go of external stuff, come inward. Yeah. Relaxing on the out-breath. Quickly checking the face. How relaxed is it? The shoulders, have they lowered? The abdomen, is it unclenched? Just a quick check. noticing now without any effort that with each in-breath, the mind is becoming sharper, brighter, clear. Making a strong intention, a strong motivation for all the meditations on emptiness. May they bear fruit. May I see things as they are, so that I can benefit not only myself, but all living beings without exception. And so we consider this inherently existing I that we perceive every moment is so strongly established that we never, ever question its presence or its existence. It seems to be, well, it just is. So successful is this I that to identify it, let alone question its truth, seems beyond comprehension to many. That it is the source of all suffering seems nonsense. We think, well, okay, perhaps this ego I causes me some trouble, but, you know, by and by, kind of, you know, you need it to keep you safe. And so I consistently and instinctively, without control, strongly grasp this phantom I and treasure it as if it were solid, permanent, and self-existent. And I don't stop there. I extend this fantasy onto friends, family, possessions, and all perceived phenomena. I project the phantom of self-existent on all of it. And so you could say that attachment and aversion, the two poisons that come from the main poison of ignorance, and all the processes that come from that lead to endless suffering. All this suffering and the delusional offspring of this phantom I that does not exist. From this delusion, there is an increased desire to secure our own welfare. The I demands it. And even if we help others, generally speaking, we helpfully ignore others. And we will engage in non-virtue and label it virtue, simply to protect and secure this I, only leading to suffering and dissatisfaction. Although we grasp day and night, awake and asleep, to this I, it is not easy to identify how the mind sees it. Please consider, if it's not easy to identify how the mind sees this I, that is a clue to its nature. to identify the I clearly, we need to allow it to develop. Please, now, recall a time when mentally you were in extremis. It could be something negative, it could be something positive, but the sense of I is strong. Set the seed in your mind now, allow it to develop. If I exist as it appears to exist, if this I exists the way it appears to, it must exist in one of four ways. This I is either the body, this I is either the mind, this I is either a combination of body and mind, or this I is separate from the body of mind. Now consider that. Is it the body, the mind, a combination of body and mind, or separate from the body and mind? There is no fifth possibility unless you can find a fifth possibility now. If the I is the body, now at this stage, many people sitting in meditation, they, well, I know it's not the body, so they skip it and move on to the next. Don't skip this. Investigate it. Be logical. Don't miss anything out. If the I is the body, then there is no sense in saying or thinking or feeling the concept of my body. That becomes nonsense. If you think the I is the body, then there's no sense in thinking or saying or feeling my body. Yet we say that all the time and we mean it. Because the possessor, my, and that which is possessed, body, cannot be the same thing. If the I is the body, does the body develop faith, trust, dream, learn, solve problems? If so, then the flesh and blood and bones can do the same. If the eye is the body, then there is no rebirth, there is no continuation of mind, because the eye will cease when the body dies. So investigate that, don't skip over it. So moving on, perhaps the eye is the mind. It's quite seductive. But if the eye is the mind, we say often, and we very strongly feel, when we say, my mind, don't interfere with my mind. These are not just words, we feel it, my mind. But again, the possessor, my, and that which is possessed, mind, cannot be the same thing. Also, there are many different types of mind. We've looked at that. Many different types of mind. Main minds, mental factors, a mind that's happy, a mind that's not. There's so many different types of mind. With all these types of mind, are they all I? So we have many I's. But perhaps there's only one special type of mind that is the I. If so, what are the other types of mind? What's their designation? We can say quite often, I know my own mind. This is illogical if the I is the mind. Perhaps, though, the eye is a combination of body and mind. I like that. It's the combination of body and mind. Okay. But since the eye is not the body, and since the eye is not the mind, how can the eye be a combination of body and mind? How can the eye be a collection of things that are not the eye, yet be the eye? If the eye is not the body, and the eye is not the mind, consider the way is where it could be. How can the eye be a combination of things that are not the eye? It's possible you could come up with a contortion, but think of it. The body you can consider like a part. The mind you consider as a part. But parts are not different in nature to the object. It can't be different. If you're leaning towards the idea that the I is not the body, not the mind, maybe not sure, but you don't think it's a collection of body and mind, there really is only one other possibility. It's separate from the body and mind. If this is so, we must be able to find it. We must be able to find that I without either the body or the mind appearing. If it's separate, we should be able to find it without the body or the mind appearing. So letting go of all this, let's see if that's possible. Imagine now the body you have beginning to slowly evaporate from the outside in. The skin is going, the tissues, the bones, the organ, all the way until just the heart is left. Imagine the body just disappearing. And imagine the heart, often thought to be the seat of the mind, not the heart itself, but that area. Imagine the mind, the heart, disappearing, dispersing, totally gone. Where is the I? There is nothing left to call I. Therefore, the I cannot be separate from my body and mind. Having examined all four possible ways this I could exist, and not being able to find a fifth way, what is the logical conclusion?